Hello, this is Mark McClure, and I play Jimmy Olsen in the Superman movies with Christopher Reeve. And you are listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome, comic book fans. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. It's no secret that my favorite comic book movie of all time is 1978's Superman the Movie. Now, it's not only my favorite comic book movie, it's one of my favorite movies, period. If you haven't had a chance yet, check out my interviews with Superman producer Ilya Salkind on episode 3 of Comic Book Central and Kryptonian villain Non, Jack O'Halloran, on episode 4. Now, Superman the Movie was, of course, directed by the legendary Richard Donner, and the cast of that movie is perfect. Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor, Margot Kidder's Lois Lane, the Kryptonian villains Zod, Ursa, and Non, Terrence Stamp, Sarah Douglas, and the aforementioned Mr. O'Halloran, and the greatest Man of Steel of all time, Christopher Reeve. But there's one character who's been around almost as long as Superman, and that would be his best pal, Daily Planet photographer Jimmy Olsen, played to perfection in that film by my guest in the lair today, Mark McClure. The Man of Steel debuted in Action Comics number 1 in 1938. By issue 6 of that same year, an unnamed office boy at the Daily Star newspaper was introduced to readers. But it wasn't until the Adventures of Superman radio program that this office boy got a name. On the episode Donnelly's Protection Racket, which aired April 15, 1940, listeners found out more about the now-renamed Daily Planet's copy boy.
As our story opens today, Clark Kent is about to leave the Daily Planet building when he is hailed by young Jimmy Olsen, a red-headed, freckle-faced copy boy who works in the editorial department of the paper.
Can I see you a minute?
Hi, what's up, Jimmy? Four alarm fire?
No, it's nothing to do with the paper, Mr. Kent.
Thanks to numerous radio appearances and the memorable performance by the great Jack Larson on the Adventures of Superman television show, Jimmy Olsen was a hit. He even got his own comic book, Superman's Pal, Jimmy Olsen, which ran for 20 years. Certainly, Jimmy Olsen is an integral part of the Superman universe. So when director Richard Donner was looking to round out his Daily Planet cast for Superman the Movie, he needed someone that could embody both Jimmy's wide-eyed optimism and his sense of adventure. Oh, and he had to look convincing in a bow tie as well. That actor was Mark McClure. Mark went on to portray Jimmy in all 4 of Christopher Reeve's Superman films, and he even showed up, camera in hand, in 1984's Supergirl. Mark's relationship with director Bob Zemeckis from the films I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars led him straight into yet another blockbuster franchise, the Back to the Future trilogy, where he played older brother Dave to Michael J. Fox's Marty McFly. Many film and television projects followed, and coming full super circle in the comic book universe, Mark appeared as a special guest on the Smallville episode Daxer as the title character, a Kryptonian scientist who basically kickstarted the construct later known as Brainiac. With this appearance, Mark proved that the Superman universe was always close to home. Well, my guest today has appeared in 2 of the biggest film franchises in history, Back to the Future, and, of course, he played James Bartholomew Olsen in the Superman series. A big welcome to Mark McClure. Mark, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Hey, we all know that Clark Kent and Jimmy Olsen are best friends in the comics and in the movies, but I don't think many of our listeners know that Clark Kent and Jimmy Olsen were in a band together.
Well, I think I have a comic book that... Yeah, where they're on stage together. I think Superman played guitar. I think Jimmy was playing guitar too. Was he on bass? Maybe Superman was on bass.
Did you help bring this to life?
I did have a band with Jeff East who played young Clark Kent in the first movie, and it was called the Daily Planet, and we had a lot of fun. Wrote a lot of original songs, and Jeff is a really good singer. I was the drummer, guitar player, songwriter, and I've been actually lately what I do now is I'm a songwriter and play a lot of guitar.
You're getting back into music again, too. Yeah, you went, this was the Daily Planet, and then it became Switch Band?
Yes, the Switch was where we all switched instruments. We would play different songs, and we'd wear these colored outfits. And yeah, that was with Jeff Beast, and I forget what year that was. Maybe in the 80s.
Probably coming late 80s, I would think, coming off the heels of Superman. And,
yeah, we just really had a lot of fun with that, and it was good music, and we took advantage of our friendship and our musical skills, and had a lot of fun.
What was your earliest interest in? Was it music? Was it acting? Because you had done commercials at a very early age, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Well, what happened was I was sent to military school, my brother and I. I was 7, he was 8, and my parents were getting a divorce, and the mother just thought that would be the best thing for us. And so we went there, and while I was, I believe I was 9 years old, and I was running around a beauty parlor in Montrose, California, and there was an agent getting their hair done next to my mom. And she just said, "Hey, your kid's got a good look. You know, would he like to do commercials? I'm a talent scout. I'm an agent." And my mom said, "Well, you know, he really can't because he's sent away to school." And but she became good friends with Pat Domigan, a wonderful lady. And when I graduated from high school, Pat just said, "Hey, do you want to try this?" And I had done a couple things before where she would kind of get me to, you know, some commercial things, and you know, it was just very hard for me to go to those things with, you know, where I was going to school. And when I graduated, she asked me if I wanted to try it, and I was like, yeah, because when I graduated, I was 4'11 and 95 pounds, and I was a good athlete, and I thought, well, God, you know, maybe I could be a jockey. So that's what I was kind of thinking I could maybe do. And but then she gave me this opportunity to act, and I just started doing it, showing up at interviews, and just started getting work without really even knowing what I was doing.
Do you remember some of those early commercials? Anything that would stick out in your mind?
Early commercials, yeah, there's a lot. Well, Joe Pitka, there was a lot of Coca-Cola, a director, a really great director, probably one of the greatest commercial directors named Joe Pitka, found me long ago, and put me into a lot of his commercials. I mean, there was a John Hancock commercial, which won an award, which won the Clio Award, and there was a Coca-Cola commercial, which won a Clio Award. And then we became kind of friends, and he used me a lot of, you know, a long time. He's a big Super Bowl director, and just a really interesting guy, and he would use me a lot. But I started doing, you know, I did Cop and the Kid with Charles Durning, where I played a 12-year-old obnoxious kid. And I did, you know, the Freaky Friday movie with Jodie Foster. And I think I was 20, maybe 19 when I did that. And, you know, I was 20 when I started with Superman, with the original film.
Yeah, how did that come to you? Because it, I mean, obviously that's one of the prime roles when you think about Jimmy Olsen. Iconic character.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Superman's best friend. So how did that role come to you? Obviously, you had had a good body of work up at that point, but I'm sure everybody and their brother's going out for this role.
Well, yeah. It was, and I never thought too much of anything when I was, you know, getting involved. I never got too excited with the business or anything. I was pretty level. And I got a call. I was living on a houseboat, Marina Del Rey, and I was working cleaning the bottom of boats, just kind of as a extra thing to do, just to have fun. And got the interview to go to Lynn Stallmaster's office, and, you know, in Wilshire there in Beverly Hills, and read for the role of Jimmy Olsen. And I was like, wow, that's nice. And so I went down there, and Tom Mankiewicz and Donner had just flown in from London.
Well, before you met them, had you known about Jimmy Olsen? Like, what was your familiarity with the character? When you thought Jimmy Olsen, what did that mean to you?
Well, the George Reeves and Jack Larson, and, you know, I mean, I knew the TV series, and I knew Jack Larson's Jimmy Olsen. I mean, I was very familiar with it. I mean, I knew who Jimmy Olsen was, and I knew, you know, like everybody, I pretty much knew about him. But when I went in the interview, Donner always wanted to live on a houseboat or live on a boat. And we just talked about boats and what was going on with living on a boat. And we were just having fun talking about that. And he just said, okay, you know, thanks for coming down. And so I didn't read or do anything. And as I was walking out, he kind of said, hey, by the way, do you even know who Jimmy Olsen is? And I turned around and said, golly, Mr. Kent. And they just started laughing, and I left. And I think it was about 3 months later, I got a call back. I was like, wow, you know, I just forgotten about it. I just figured it was done. And I went back in there, and I was sitting with an actor in the lobby, and I won't mention his name, but I kind of came in there, and he's sitting there. He's like, hey, I said, you're going for Jimmy Olsen, too? And he goes, no, I'm going for Winnie the Pooh. And he's like, kind of just like a smart ass answer, and kind of, you know, made me pretty uncomfortable pretty quick. And I was like, oh, okay.
Well, somebody going in with that attitude is probably not going to get Jimmy Olsen as it is.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't have the Jimmy spirit just on that alone. And, I mean, he's a good actor, and you would recognize the guy I'm talking about, or know the guy I'm talking about. But so I go in there, and Donner just said, I just wanted to remember what you looked like. You got the part, and about a week later, I was off and running to London.
Had that interim, that where you had gone away and a few months had gone by, are you thinking, man, I hope I get it. Man, I hope this is going to be great. Or did it just be, were you just, eh,
no,
whatever.
Yeah, I was never that way. I was always just kind of, I never hung on to any of it. I was just like, hey, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen, I was having a good life. I was, you know, playing my music. I was, you know, we had California Fever. I think California Fever, a TV series that I was doing, is, I think that was happening right around that time. And I had done the Walt Disney films. And, you know, I was very happy and grateful that I was doing anything. So, you know, kind of crossing my fingers and hoping for, you know, the Superman job wouldn't have been my style. It was just been, if it happens, that's cool. But if it doesn't happen, I know there's more adventures in life. But it was, getting that role was, without me knowing it at the time, and probably without me knowing it today, was more than special. I mean, more than a, you know, for something like that to happen in a lifetime, it's pretty special.
Yeah, it's iconic. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, we're just finishing up, or we just celebrated Superman's 75th anniversary.
Yeah.
Certainly Jimmy Olsen's 75th as well. I mean, he made that, it wasn't by name, but he was mentioned in issue number 6. So he was there.
No,
he's right along there from the beginning.
He's a strong name, and he's a strong character. And Jack Larson, I mean, I've sat with Jack many times, and what a great guy. And
well, for our listeners, know, too, one of the greatest on the Smallville season 7 DVD set. There's a featurette where you get to sit down not only with Jack but some of the other Jimmy Olsons as well, Aaron Ashmore and Sam Huntington.
Yeah, I remember doing that. I didn't know that was for Smallville. So they put that in the Smallville thing?
That's on the Smallville Season 7 DVD. Yeah, if you take out one of the discs,
cool.
It's on there. And, yeah, you guys get to just sit around and talk Jimmy Olsen. How cool was that?
Yeah, that was pretty fun and just kind of weird. But it was fun, and, you know, and Jack, he's the man. I mean, he is Jimmy Olsen. He set him up Jack set him up because of his innocence. I mean, he really, Jack really, really nailed his wide-eyed, bow-tied wearing character. And just from me watching Jack do his thing, Jimmy Olsen was, I mean, I totally understood who Jimmy Olsen was. And it was just about his energy and his love for life and his jumping into things before he thinks about the consequences. Yeah. You know, Jimmy Olsen is a person that just is going before he's thinking about it. He'll, you know, and then he finds himself in a situation. But he was a really easy character to play for me. Very easy.
Well, when you got on the set with Richard Donner, I mean, obviously you had been with a lot of directors leading up to that point. What was the difference with Donner? What did you notice with him, and what were you able to learn from Richard Donner?
Well, the only thing I can say that I'm sure you've heard before from everybody else that you've talked to involved in the film, Dick Donner, is as special a director as, I mean, directors are so important to projects. I mean, there's not very many really good ones. Otherwise, there'd be a lot of good movies. Dick Donner, Bob Zemeckis, Ron Howard. I mean, these are directors that I've been fortunate enough to work with, and these guys are the best of the best. Dick Donner is such a, he reminded me of my father. He's just so loud and happy and involved and personable on a set. You just want to work for this guy. You do not want to disappoint Dick Donner. You want to make him smile even more. And he really was so special when it came to Superman. I mean, he was everything. And I don't even know, my words aren't giving it justice. I mean, in life, you have to experience things to really understand them. And having Donner run that ship, he was the only guy. Christopher Reeve was the only guy that could have played Superman. Dick Donner was the only guy that could have directed Superman. Margot Kidder was the only one that could have played Lois. I guess Mark McClure was the only one that could have played Jimmy. I mean, everything came together for that film. I mean, it was really I don't know how to describe it, but everything came together.
Well, there's a lot of serendipity that goes on with that film. And one thing I noticed about it, too, which separates it from a lot of other films, is just, and Donner was always trying to talk about verisimilitude and being realistic.
Yeah.
The dialogue in the film where people are acting, they're not reading lines. It's not, here's my line, here's your line, beat, here's your line. There's a conversation going on, even between you and Jackie Cooper, is Perry White. He's yelling at you, get me coffee, no sugar. And to talk about that scene there where you just have this conversation with Jackie Cooper.
Well, what happened there was that particular scene, Dick Donner, when you would first show up on the set, like a lot of directors, and I'll just mention Richard Lester, who kind of took over the Superman 2 when they fired Donner. I mean, you would walk on the set, and he would place you on an X and say your line there, and then walk over there and say another line over there, and just right there, there goes any kind of natural thing going on. And it's for Donner. You would get on the set and you would just start to find things, like just start rehearsing and start seeing, where do you want to walk? What do you want to do? What's feeling right? He would allow the freedom to create while you're on the set. And then as he's watching, start to figure out where he's got to cover it. And there's so much freedom to that. And as far as that scene with Jackie Cooper, he was doing his thing, his on camera was first. I mean, they were doing his close up first. They did the master, then they're doing his close up, and then he accidentally said, he got confused and just said, "Don't call me Sugar," and he was supposed to say, "Don't call me Chief." That was the written line.
That's the iconic line. Yeah, that's the comic book line.
Yeah. Oh no. I was the one who got filmed first, and he said that line, and I just reacted just to it, like, "Right, Sugar," and that's what made the film. And Jackie just kind of messed up his line. So when they turned around and did Jackie's close-up, they had him do the Sugar line where he messes it up. And that's what they used. And that's the kind of thing that Donner brought out by the way he went about doing things, that you can get those natural moments that just kind of happen, and then you get a natural reaction. And there was a lot of that. I mean,
well, what I love about that scene, too, is when you turn around, and, like, as soon as you say it, you turn to the copy boy, too, and you're like, "Get me a sugar." Like Jimmy Olsen's, like, emulating him, but out of earshot.
Oh, yeah. No, he was acting like a big shot.
Right, right.
And he could, because he was in the chief's office. I mean, he was in the group.
Yes.
Somehow.
Beautiful scene.
He got to hang out with the bigwigs.
Beautiful scene. Well, you were going to mention, so what were some of the other things, the sort of happy accidents that came about?
I just know with Margie. I mean, she was so, she was so good with her energy and her interaction with Chris. They were really back and forth because Chris was very serious. There was a thing where like we were on wires very early on. I'm not quite sure if it was, I guess it must have been the Hoover Dam sequence. And I was on the wires with Chris, and we were 40 feet above the stage. I mean, just hanging there, and it was just really uncomfortable. And, you know, he's in his colors. And, you know, when you saw Chris, and you're in the room where he's standing next to you in his colors, I mean, it's, I mean, he's the guy. And so I'm up there on the wires, and I'm rambling away like I'm rambling away right now. And he just said, hey, you know, if you can just talk like Jimmy Olsen, just be like Jimmy Olsen, that would really help me. And I was like, wow, you know, we're up here on this wire, and it's like, okay. And I'm not the kind of actor that stays in character all the time, you know, and Jimmy Olsen is kind of me anyway. But at that moment, I really did realize that Chris, you know, he had a lot to think about. I mean, he had a lot of responsibility, and I was so grateful to him for kind of tipping me off early on of where, what he needed to do his thing, and the respect I needed to show him while he was doing his thing. And that really helped me a lot. And I always kind of remember that where, you know, that moment where he just asked that, you know, I kind of stay in the character for his sake. And when he was off the set, when we were, you know, going to parties around London and everything, he was a goofball. I mean, he really was. He was like the king of the goofballs. But when it was time to be on the set and working, and the responsibility that he had, that he took on, I mean, I totally understand it. And I totally understand where he was coming from when he asked me to do that.
Yeah, we'd heard from others that Chris was very method when he was as Superman or as Clark Kent. And you even see that on some of the DVD, the making of films, when he's up there with Margot on the wires and she's goofing around. And he's like, would you be serious? You know?
Yeah, and no, it really is. I mean, he had a lot of responsibility. I mean, he was taking something on, and I loved the casting because I'd always known that there were, you know, Sylvester Stallone or Robert Redford or whatever that stuff was. But, you know, to get Christopher Reeve, and I've been rooting for these other Jimmy Olsen or these other Supermans that have been coming along, and it's a tough one, man. It's a tough act to follow. Christopher Reeve is, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, he really just nailed it, and he was the guy, and I don't know if anybody else could do what he did. And I was really rooting for this last film, and you know, it was good, there's no Jimmy in it. It's just, and that's really bothersome to me, because here you have these characters. Just give us good story. That's all we want. Give it to Mike Carlin at DC Comics and let him write the story. I mean, just give it to somebody that's capable of this. It was just so bizarre, and those fight scenes, and then I was kind of laughing by the end of it. You know, I really was, and I went in really rooting for it, because I wanted somebody to kind of take the torch and move on with it. And they're still going to make another one, whatever. But this one, I was just kind of laughing at the end. And I don't even remember, you know, they were fighting so much, I kind of lost touch with all that, and so destructive. And I didn't even realize how Superman killed the bad guy. You know what I mean? Somebody asked me, he said, right, you know how he killed him? And I was like, God, to tell you the truth, I don't even remember. I remember he was kind of doing some x-ray, you know, some fire vision and trying to get that family. And, you know, he broke his neck. And I was like, what? He broke his neck. And I was like, well, yeah, I guess that was.
I was a little numb. I was a little numb at that point with the CGI destruction and the buildings. Look, I like the movie, but I'm like you. I got to the end and I'm like, oh, if he kills him, I don't know how I'm going to, and I just can't see. It's a different Superman. I mean, it's a different.
It was a different Superman, and I kind of respect where we are, that it needs to be more of a roller coaster ride. But in the same breath, man, if I can't believe what I'm watching, I have a tough time with any film.
Yeah.
And I just kind of, that film kind of jumped for me about midway through. It kind of lost me.
Well, I think Jack O'Halloran said it best in his interview. He says, well, they haven't done it as yet.
No.
And I agree with
really, that. And we are, I'm fortunate to have been in some really good projects. And the Superman from 1978 is still king to me.
I've always said that's the gold standard. Hey, you know what's interesting about Superman the movie too is it starts off with a comic book flipping over and you hear a little girl's voice sort of narrating it.
Yeah.
You've been able to keep this a little bit in the family when you look at, again, going to the DVD extras. There's a Making of Superman documentary that you had worked on. We hear a very familiar voice in that documentary, don't we?
My little daughter, Melody. Well, my big girl, Melody, my 24-year-old daughter, Melody, was the voice in the hand flipper of that comic book for the Making of Superman and Taking Flight and all those really great documentaries. There's that great can set that they made with all, I think it's all the films, and I think Supergirl's in there, and all those specials, and it's very cool set. If you don't have it, I think people should definitely have that one.
And it's a fantastic documentary too. So I love how they sort of channel the earlier film by giving your daughter that little part to do. I thought that was kind of a nice touch.
Yeah, Michael Fa, the good man who did a lot of those documentaries. You can't make me any happier.
Of course, you put my daughter to work. Hey, Superman 3, as we moved along, you know, we've talked about Superman 2 with some of the other, and certainly, you know, all the problems there were well documented, and but still an unbelievable film as it comes out. But Superman 3, I noticed, sort of a change for Jimmy. You got a couple of extra scenes in there, and it seems like a much more confident Jimmy Olsen in Superman 3.
I can't recall too much from it. I know we filmed up there in Calgary, and you know, Richard Lester was at the helm once again, and it was always very strange. After Donner left, which was, you know, pretty early, it never quite was there. You know, it never quite had that family thing going on. And Chris was always, you know, kind of saying he didn't want to do another one. It was very hard for the studios, even with Canon Films, when they did Superman 4, I mean, just to get Chris to do another one, he was, you know, really hesitant to keep going back. And, you know, as we know, like he did Death Trap and, you know, Somewhere in Time and, you know, all those films. And it's so interesting that he really tried to get some character work that took him as far away from Superman as he could. You know, he really did not want to have his body of work known as Superman. He wanted somebody to say, hey, you were pretty good in this other stuff. But it's like, you know, Tom Wilson, Biff in Back to the Future. I mean, he just nailed it so hard. And for him to kind of be able to walk away from that character when he walks into an office, like, you know, casting people, they're like, you know, we love you, and he's Tom Wilson's the funniest guy, the greatest guy, but you just have to say, you were Biff. I mean, I don't care what other roles you do, that's who we remember you as, because it was just so good. And Chris was kind of in that same kind of thing where he's just so good as Superman that anything else he did would be okay, would be good, but you're still Superman.
But when you have something so iconic, I mean, it just becomes ingrained in the public.
Yeah.
And you know what? I mean, we're still talking about it all these years later, so you guys all did something right. Superman 3,
yeah.
I thought it was an interesting line, one of your lines that you have in there, looking at the pictures of Ross Webster and Lois, Margot Kidder as Lois, says, oh, he's good looking. And you say, yeah, because I gave him an F2 out of 50. You a photographer, or somebody write that for you?
Yeah. Well, I did start to take that on, and yeah, that was always fun. I always had film in the camera, and I just always turned that film into the property department, and so I never knew what happened to it. But I always had film in my camera, like when in Superman 1, when the boys were breaking into the Daily Planet, that was loaded on the automatic drive. I mean, I was always really taking pictures, which was cool.
And do you still have them?
No, I don't have them. I always turned them in. I always turned them into the boys, and I never, you know, it wasn't mine. So I wish, you know, looking back, boy, I would have loved to have grabbed a cape. I know I had some stuff that I donated to Metropolis, you know, some of Jimmy's outfits. So they got those at the Metropolis
Oh, at the Superman Museum, yeah, in Metropolis.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah, so there's some stuff up there. And I know they have some stuff at Smithsonian, too.
Okay.
But I don't have a whole lot of memorabilia from there, and it's one of these days. I know in my garage, our garage is stuffed, and I got a lot of stuff in there. And I got one of these days go through these boxes, and I'm sure I'll go back memory lane.
Well, it's not surprising you had the camera there, because Perry always said a photographer eats with his camera.
Sleeps with his camera.
That's right. So.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
there was a great scene there too, because in Superman 3, as you know, people say one thing or the other about the movie. You know, it's too comedic with Richard Pryor, whatever. There are some amazing scenes in there, and one of them is the chemical plant fire, which
That was huge.
That's an actual chemical plant.
Yeah, that was actually a pretty huge production at the time, just with the fires, the cranes, the wires getting Chris flying in and flying him out. I mean, it was a gigantic undertaking just to even get all the different things that were going on there. It was such a, you know, like you say, it was really at the plant. There really was fire, and it was fun. And then that's when we were hanging out in Calgary for all that stuff. Kind of, I don't even know if that reads in the film that you can. If it looked like Metropolis.
I mean, they're heading to Smallville. Ran. Yeah, they're kind of out in there's cornfields there as they're heading out, and there's this big plant out in the middle of nowhere. But you get to climb. And is that actually you climbing up on the fire truck and the ladder?
Yeah. I did that. I was always into, you know, just any project I've ever done. If I could do the stunt, if they would let me do the stunt, I would want to do the stunt. And just to do it, just to be the actor doing it, you know. And,
anything,
that was always fun.
Anything
that was
dangerous?
No. I mean, maybe it was, but I didn't know at the time. You know, I was a good athlete. I could do anything I put my mind to, and I love doing that kind of stuff. Love that. And I love the Hoover Dam stuff that we were doing up there. And, you know, any chance I get to do, you know, stunts, I love it. I love the opportunity.
And you got to work a little more closely with Christopher Reeve on that one, I think, didn't you?
You
got the Smallville scene. So what did you – just for people that never got a chance to know him, or, you know, not to know him personally, really what was he like, and what did you get out of that friendship that you had with him?
Chris was a serious stage actor. I mean, it was very important to him, and he trained with the best – and, you know, I don't come from any training. So I've got a lot of respect for anybody that is doing what he was doing, as far as taking a character and bringing him to life in a real way. You know, whether I don't know if you could ever do Superman on stage, but to take a character and then make him believable, make you believe that he's real. That's the trick to acting. That's what I've always loved about acting, is making these people real. Making any, you know, when you're watching celluloid, that you believe what you're watching. You believe the people that you're watching. And Chris, he was such so strong on the set. I mean, just a great guy to watch, a great guy to act with. I mean, because he was just giving you, he was giving you everything. I mean, you just had to listen to him and react, and you're going to be in a safe place. And off the set, when we were at parties and everything, he was the biggest goofball, great piano player, but just a real goofball that would just play tricks on everybody. You just have to keep your eyes open with him. And it was so good, and maybe that was just his way of getting as far away from the work, you know, where he can just be stupid and act idiotic, you know. And then, you know, when it comes time to get serious, he goes the other way. He goes the other way so much that it's, you know, it's so intense. And I always thought that when he's going to be a director, that, you know, really, really watch it, because this guy is, from here on out, is going to do special things. And he really did. I mean, what he did, you know, for the last 9 years, I believe he survived 9 years. He made it as special as he could, and he could have very easily just drifted into the abyss and not come out because it was so difficult for him to travel. But he really made an effort to keep his voice being heard and to try to do something with this tragedy. I mean, it was incredible in our lifetime for Christopher Reeve to go through what he went through. It's incredible. And just on that alone puts his lifetime above many lifetimes. You know, it's crazy.
Well, he became the character. He became the inspiration. He channeled
that.
Yeah,
he did.
Because he knew what it meant to others. So, yeah, being able to use that iconic status was, what can you say about him? He was amazing.
Yeah, he really, I mean, in like I say, in our lifetime, he will go down as one of the inspirations of it.
Well, yeah, it's amazing, and you got a chance to work with him so many times. And even a bit of trivia here, 2014 is now the 30th anniversary of Supergirl, the movie. You are the only actor to have been in both worlds. You Jimmy Olsen was the tie between the two worlds.
Yeah, I got to hang out in Supergirl's world, that crazy Faye Dunaway and
High Camp, the High Camp
story.
Yeah, what do you think? I mean, looking back on it, what do you kind of think about it when you see it?
That film, I mean, it was really fun with Helen Slater and Hart Parkner and Faye Dunaway and Brenda Vaccaro. It was, and another great thing that came out of it for me was Peter Cook. We became very good friends, and he died a short time after that. And it really was, as far as just life. That film was really good for me and the people that I met on that film. But the film itself, I know Junot Schwartz, who directed it, he was coming off of, I think, Jaws 2 or Jaws 3, I don't know. But he kept saying it was the greatest sequel of all time. And, you know, it was an okay movie, but it definitely wasn't the greatest sequel of all time. And he just, didn't really have a grasp of believability. And that goes back to early on when I was talking about directors, you know, to make, you know, there's some good ones and there's not so good ones. And for one moment, I nothing in that film was believable. And that's hard, you know, when you're watching a comic book type of story, you know. It's, you gotta believe what's going on. If it becomes goofy and
It's high camp.
Doesn't really work.
Yeah, it's high camp, yeah. And it worked for the Batman TV show. But when Donner has set the template, and it's in that universe, it's tough to go back to the old Batman TV show kind of.
Yeah, no, it's just got to be believable, and for some reason, Supergirl just never rang true to me. And
but Slater was amazing. I thought Helen Slater was amazing, though. I thought she
was great.
Yeah.
She really was great, and she really worked hard at making that work. But it just the way it was photographed and the way it was told, just missed the mark. Just missed it.
Well, that's one of those interesting footnotes to the franchise too. But you got to bridge both worlds, so that was kind of cool.
No, I've got my lifetime has been. It's been very good, and I'm very grateful for it all, no doubt about it. I don't know, I mean, you know, one of these days I think I'll really take it all in of what I've done, you know, in my lifetime and you know, how lucky I've been in my career.
Well, you mentioned amazing directors. You mentioned amazing directors. Bob Zemeckis is one of those. You got to work with him on I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars, and then all of a sudden you're in the Back to the Future franchise.
Yeah, with Wendy Jo Sperber. Me and
the
Wendy
late,
got to ride along. Yeah. She was a beautiful woman.
Oh, the comedic timing.
And, yeah.
No, and the look.
So yeah, she got, and I got to try out for 1941, me and Bobby DiCicco. We went down to some place in Hollywood, and Spielberg had us do a dance-off, and Bobby DiCicco was just the man when it came to dancing. I was like, just give it to Bobby. I can't compete with this guy. And he really did a great job in the film. But Bob Zemeckis is definitely one of the, well, he's in the top five with directors and innovation, and just what he does with celluloid is just incredible. Bob Zemeckis is, he's definitely one of the good guys in the business, and I've been fortunate to hang around that guy, and I'm glad he got finally got his Academy Award. You know, he deserved that. He'll get many more.
Well, and with Back to the Future, it's one of those movies, again, that you kind of run into the same thing you did on Superman 2, where there's a change, this time it's with an actor, and you have to come in and reshoot a lot of this.
Yeah.
What are the challenges that poses to you as an actor, where you've done all the work, and then you're like, well, I've got to do it all over again?
Well, that was a big, big move. I mean, that never happened. Usually people would just fool themselves and just say, hey, we're going to make this work. We'll fix it in editing. And for some reason, Universal was brave enough to say, hey, look, we believe in you guys and we believe in this story enough to say, hey, we'll lose all of that film and get this actor who's working all day long, and he comes and works all night on this project. And and it kind of goes with life, where everything's kind of meant to be. Michael J. Fox was meant to do that role, and there would have been no other person to play that role. And then, same thing with me, where, here's a guy who kind of, gets Parkinson's, and he gets up to the podium and starts talking about it. I mean, here, got involved with another guy that's dealing with some real life issues, and he took it on like Chris took it on, and it's like, I was real proud of Mike for doing all this stuff he does, and he's another great guy in my lifetime. I mean, he's just a real nice guy to talk to, and as humbled as anybody, and he worked his ass off on Back to the Future. I mean, because he was working all day long, then he'd come there and work at night, and he really was good. And just sitting around the dinner table, I mean, one thing with Eric, kind of was taking it, we're back to the method acting, where he wanted you to kind of talk to him as Marty on the set, and it was just like this really, I mean, it was kind of a...
And this is Eric Stoltz, who was the original Marty McFly.
Exactly, and it was one of those where that was the first time. I mean, Chris was one way when it came to his method, and Eric was kind of almost went further with it, and it's just like, you're sitting around eating carrots at craft service, and he starts talking to you like Marty, and it was just, it was like almost surreal. Chris didn't take it to the snack table. He took it when the camera's in front of him and he's prepping for the scene. That's where Chris was. Eric was walking around everywhere, with the Marty guy. Right. And it was just kind of very odd. So it's very odd when you find yourself in that situation where you're kind of talking to the guy, and it's like you don't know how to talk to him. So it's just, I think for a lot of the people, even with Zemeckis, I mean, it probably threw him off, where he's trying to talk to him, and is he talking to Eric? Is he talking to Marty? Is he, it was just an added element that was, I just think, didn't make everybody that was working around it, wasn't comfortable. And I think, if you saw that, I mean, I didn't even see the footage, but something must have been ringing really stale with his performance as far as being Marty. Maybe whether it be too stiff, I'm not sure what it was.
Well, it seems more structured than manic. I think the key to Marty was manic, that there's that wild energy that Fox brings to the role.
I guess you get that from
Zemeckis, too, because isn't he just, like, wild and crazy on set? Just, like, this kind of...
Zemeckis... Bob Z is not—he's not wild and crazy, but he's got a great laugh, and he just walks around like he wears Levi's, and his Levi's—I mean, he's kind of got that plumber crack going. His pants are real low, and they look like they're about to fall off, and he's just setting up shots and having a laugh. He really knows what he wants to see, but he's not—you compare him to Donner, it's two different guys. Zemeckis really, I think he came in more prepared. Donner's kind of found things on the set, where Zemeckis came to the set knowing what he needed to get, and he kept filming until he got it. But Bob Z's pretty funny on the set. He's just like, you wouldn't even know who the director was.
Just a guy.
Really, in a lot of the cases, yeah, you wouldn't even, if you came onto the set, you'd have to kind of look around a little bit to find out who the director was.
Well,
I think he's getting more of the, you'd know who the director is.
Get a little more serious, yeah. About the, yeah.
A little bit more on the director. You know, like he, I don't know if it's believing himself more or whatever it is, but, He's the man.
Well, when you look at the trilogy, we kind of a little bit disappointed that you're not in the second movie, but you actually are in the second movie, Back to the Future 2.
Yes. Well, it was cut out. Bob Gale had called me up and said they were having screenings, and what happened was Wendy Jo Sperber was pregnant at the time, and she couldn't film a lot of the scenes. She just couldn't, because she had to lay in bed. She was having a tough time, and she was pretty much had to stay in bed with doctor's orders. And so she couldn't film a lot of the stuff. And when they did the screening, the questionnaires came back was, where's the sister? And they see the brother, where's the sister? And they kind of thought, well, eliminate that question. So just get rid of both family members and, just kind of, so there's no question of, I don't even know where are they. I guess if there's a scene with me in it and Wendy wasn't there,
you're stumbling out of Biff's pleasure palace and
always
completely
together.
Drunk. Yeah.
Yep. And,
it's on the DVD extras. So we do see it.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. They'll see. They're good. And actually, I think, Zemeckis, directed, a lot of that stuff. He was doing Second Unit at the time because, what happened was, because Mike was working at night, and they had to really do some catching up. So I know Spielberg was directing a lot of stuff at the same time. Bob was doing his stuff, and that was pretty cool. Those guys were brothers.
So Spielberg actually did some of the directing on the film?
Yeah. Well, Bob lived at Spielberg's house for a little bit, and in a little back house that he had there, and they would just kind of edit back there. And yeah, and Spielberg would do a Second Unit. I don't know if he got credit for it. He probably didn't, but he did a lot of Second Unit stuff.
Wow. I mean, that's just to be directed by Bob Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg on the same project.
Oh, it's crazy.
Sometimes wake up and go, how did this happen?
No, I at the time I wasn't thinking about it, but looking back, it was like these were the hot shots at the time. Yeah. I mean, these were the guys that were,
it's as big as it gets.
Studios were, oh my God, it's so fun. So fun. And they're both doing whatever they want to do. I mean, it's hard work doing films. I know that.
Well, we mentioned Back to the Future too. 2015 is the year Marty travels to. Boy, it's coming right around the corner. Who would have guessed?
Yeah.
Anybody calling you? Any talks about anything big going on for 2015 for Back to the Future?
Well, I know Bob Z, he always wanted to release another version of Back to the Future 2, because he filmed it with a lot more violence and things that he took out and, had to leave on the cutting room floor. And I know he's always talked about wanting to re-release it with, more mayhem in it, at Biff's place. And so maybe there is something in the works for, that magical date. That'd be a great thing. I mean, what is it? Back to the Future? Is it 30 years? Back to the Future 30?
1985. Superman's. Yes, it was Superman's 35th in 2013.
Yeah.
And, coming up, Back to the Future was 1985, so we're coming up in 2015.
Wow.
Some big anniversaries coming up.
Is that crazy?
I
don't know if that's crazy or not.
Maybe we'll see the return of Dave McFly in Back to the Future 2.
Yeah, or Back to the Future 5.
We'll take whatever we can get. It's a great series.
Oh my God, it was magical. I do remember going to the screening, and when it was over, I mean, you go to these screenings. I've been fortunate enough to go to screenings and really have a good film in front of me. And there's some screenings where you kind of go and you see, and you just kind of clap, and you try to get your, you get your little hors d'oeuvres and get out of there without, trying to tell, it's a great film, and not so great, but. Back to the Future was one of those where when the lights came up, or when the film ended. I mean, it was with the cast and the crew. I think it was a standing ovation. I mean, people started clapping and kept clapping because we all realized we just saw, what did we just see? Because even when you're reading the script, it, you know, it's like, wow, you know, how's this all going to happen?
Yeah.
It was really to read the script.
It's so complex.
And you know, they had a lot of technology back then, but not as much as they have now. And everybody in cast and crew, I just think when they saw that film, it was just like, what was that?
Anything in that movie that we don't know about? Because there's stuff hidden everywhere. Anything? Because a lot of stuff has been talked about, Easter eggs, you know, buried throughout the film. Is there anything that you know that really hasn't come out, or something Zemeckis put on the set?
The only thing I would say that maybe hasn't come out, or maybe people do know about, is that Tom Wilson worked harder and longer than anybody I've ever known on a project. He was so good and so important to that project. I don't know if everybody really realizes how important the Biff character was to Back to the Future. And he's a real quiet guy about it. He really is. But Tom Wilson, boy, did he knock it out of the park for a first-timer. And, you know, and just the sequels. An incredible actor. And an incredible person. He was really he was a gem in all that stuff.
He's in a lot of scenes. He's carrying a lot of weight.
And even the makeup chair, just everything that he did for that film was really, really big. Really big. And just, you know, I don't think anybody will ever know how hard he worked on that thing.
Oh, and even Mad Dog Tannen in the third one. It's just... You know.
Oh yeah.
You got to have an antagonist.
Yeah, you got to have an antagonist, but the way he just played all of his different parts. I mean, it's like Chris playing two guys. I mean, you know, Tom was playing all kinds of guys. I mean,
right.
Just different levels. Kids. He was. I mean, he must have read the script and his head would have exploded. Saying, "Well, how am I going to be? How am I doing all this?
Right.
You know, how much? But anyway, I think he's an unknown. I don't know. He just was such
a force.
An important commodity to that. Oh, my God.
He's a force. He's an absolute force that comes out. I think that's why he's so identifiable with that role, because it was so huge. It was so memorable. I mean, Butthead. I mean, who didn't say Butthead?
Right.
Anytime they saw that movie, that became part of what the culture was.
Yeah, and he, like Christopher Reeve, was unknown coming into it. And I love that in pictures where you can meet somebody and have them be so special right out of the shoot, you know? And I know there's so much talent on this planet when it comes to actors and things like that we don't know about. And they just need the chance. They just need the opportunity. And they need to kind of hook up with the best director they can find and the best possibility.
Donner, Zemeckis, that helps.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not easy, man. It's just, I don't even know. And you can't force any of that. It's not like you can't even beg for that stuff. You know, it just has to happen. And, you know, and then you take advantage of it and go.
Well, it's happened to you. Cool. It's happened to you. And there's one quick thing I wanted to ask you about, too. Coming full circle, Smallville. You finally got to come back into the Superman world again, playing Dax Ur, the Kryptonian scientist.
That was really nice. I mean, that was I loved the producers of that show, and it was really it was fun to do. And I always kind of thought they could have probably put Tom. They probably could have made him, you know, put him into the film. I wonder if there was any talk of like, hey, why don't we just get this guy? Because I know he never put on the outfit on the TV show. And I kind of thought, you know, maybe it would be an easy segue to get that guy into a film, have him eventually get that outfit on, which would be a very nice thing. But I don't know. I don't know how much if they even played with that, because he established himself pretty well. I liked the show. I liked him. He had a good look. And he seemed to capture the youthfulness and just kind of the awe of just kind of being from a different place. I mean, he seemed to have all the ingredients of the character. It's just that he never really flew. He never put on the outfit.
All right. Well, and I think for fans of Smallville and who are also fans of the Donner series that you were such a huge part of, I like how Smallville worked that Donner era in. The Fortress of Solitude was the same. Christopher Reeve made an appearance. Margot Kidder made an appearance. You made an appearance. Terrence Stamp was the voice of Jor-El. So they were always trying to find ways to bring the Donner years kind of back into it.
It kind of seems like it would have been an easy thing for Warner Brothers just to grab him and go with it.
Yeah.
Because you're right. I mean, he established himself, and the fact that they had all the ingredients there and they had the characters. I thought that Jimmy was really good in there, and everybody kind of had the spirit of the comics. You know, they really did. There was a good spirit to that show, and that's what you need on the big screen. You need character. You need these characters, and it's back to why they left Jimmy out of. I think somebody told me that the girl, which
Jenny.
I didn't catch, was the Jimmy.
She's Jenny.
Was supposed to.
Yeah, there's.
She,
I don't
the
know
girl
that
it was in the rubble.
Yeah, we don't know that if it's Jenny Olsen, if she's replacing Jimmy, or if it's a sister. So I don't think that that's been determined yet. But, man, it misses Jimmy.
She was in the credit as Jenny Olsen?
I think she's credited as Jenny. I'd have to look again, but I think the rumor was that she was Jenny Olsen.
I wonder what the story is, why they would drop Jimmy.
Something different.
What would that even be in the storyboard meetings? I mean, it's like, what?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, why don't you just go make up something else then? Just call it... Flubberman or something,
right?
You know, just call it anything but Superman, because here you have the ingredients for the pie, and it's 75 years old, and it's what are you doing? It just need, if somebody can't write a story, then wait till somebody can write a story that we care about. You know, don't rush something out that's dark and you know, just all this violence and with no, you know, the reality of destroying. I mean, Metropolis was destroyed. I forget the other town they were in. They destroyed that.
Yeah, Smallville kind of like got a hurting.
Yeah, and you got these two guys that kind of have similar powers. No one's going to win. You know, we might as well play a game of checkers and call it even. You know, because no one's more powerful than the other. You're going to keep flying through rockets and buildings. It was just like, wow, 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 wow. And like I say, I really went into the theater hoping that, you know, the torch was going to be passed, and I didn't see that happen. I mean, maybe it was. I don't know. I know they're doing these sequels with Batman, which sounds fun. I love the idea of, you know, mixing them with all these other guys. That could work. But, you know, Superman should definitely stand alone. You know, and if Hollywood can't figure out how to do that, then just leave it alone.
Well, I think Bryan Singer gave it a shot. I mean, he certainly tried to tie in the Donner era, and he also brought Jack Larson in. For a scene in the bar.
And the music.
Yeah, and the music was great. Yeah, so I think it's just a whole different era. Whole different era
it
for
is.
Superman
it,
now.
It,
but.
It, yeah, yeah, they're just trying to figure out how to make it 2013 or 2015.
Yeah.
Whatever they're trying to do. But I know what's most important is if we don't believe in these characters, it's a hard thing to continue on with. I mean, just make us believe.
That's it. Hey, one quick question about Smallville I wanted to ask. Your character, Dax Ur, at the very end, he obviously created Brainiac, and then Brainiac comes in at the end and kind of takes some memory. Does he kill you? We don't really know. Is Dax Ur okay? Because I feel bad for Grayson from Max.
I don't know, but I know he kind of had the, he had all the, you know, the serums and everything to keep himself going.
Okay.
And, I'm not quite sure. How did the show even end? How did they?
Well, we see Brainiac taking, you know, taking the information. He kind of jabs him in the neck and takes the information out.
Yeah.
When I watch it, I just kind of like to think that maybe he just has a little bit of amnesia and he's still okay.
I would keep that alive. I would say yes.
Okay.
I mean, you know,
Grace and Max are there.
Yeah,
I felt so bad. I'm like, oh, come on! The guy's just trying to be a Kryptonian living on Earth with no powers, you know?
Yeah, and that was a fun. I guess it was a fun way to go. If he had to go,
if he went, if he went.
But it was an honor to do that show, and it was kind of fun just to have that little tie in, you know.
Well, it's kind of nice too because it ties in with the comics because there's a. A great Superman story called Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, where Kal-El gives up his powers and becomes a mechanic.
Oh, really?
He's working in a garage. Yeah, so.
I like that. Well, maybe that's the
nice little
that's
time.
Where it all started.
That's I hope, you know, it's, that's why I like to think of Dexter is still out there somewhere, just raising a family, working in the garage.
Well, he is. He's in Palm Springs having his shower remodeled.
Awesome. That's what we wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Kurt,
no, Dexter's just fine.
What's going on in the life of Mark McClure now? You mentioned the music. Where can we see you next?
Well, I'm playing a lot of places down here in Palm Springs. It's just me and my 12-string guitar. I've been writing a lot of songs. I lost my brother and my mother at the end of 2012, and that really changed my life and what I wanted to do. And I'm still available to Hollywood, but I've taken some time off as far as acting and stuff. And I'm just kind of writing songs, and I'm kind of just doing things for Mark, and I really love it. I'm in a little bit of an unknown area right now, very happy. I've got my little poodle. I've got my beautiful wife. I've got my lovely daughter, and life is really good writing songs. I'm writing every day, and I play every day, and I'm liking this whole new life. I moved out of Los Angeles, and life is good. Life is good, and it's a new thing for me. I've been calling it Chapter 4 of my life, and Chapter 4 of my life right now is writing songs, performing the songs, and riding my bike with my dog every morning, which is cool.
Is this kind of new lease on life? Is this reflected in your music, or should I say, how is it reflected in your music?
No. It's my lyrics are really important to me, and my songs of late pretty reflective, and seems like God is involved. Even though I'm not a big religious person, it has a lot of these songs have a lot to do with faith and where I am. So it's good, and it's good to sing. I mean, it's really, I find myself when I'm performing on stage, sometimes I'll really, really have a lot of emotion, and it's not quite sure why it's happening, but it's very powerful, and I do like my words that I'm singing, which makes performing really good, but it's very interesting. All I'll say is I'm very happy doing what I'm doing, and it's interesting because being an actor, you want to project, and the more I play live, the more intimate I'm getting with myself. Where I don't feel like I have to have the person in the last row hear me. If they want to hear me, stop talking and listen. but I'm learning not to project, which was my whole life. Performing for the camera and performing for somebody to be heard. Somebody to hear you in the back row. Where now, I'm learning to just be in such a moment with the song and make that song as good as you can, for that 4 minutes that you're playing it. And it's very interesting. It's very interesting to get there. Because my voice is like a Bob Dylan kind of a voice, where it's just I'm not really singing. I'm singing and talking. I don't even know what it is, but. To try to be in the moment when you perform these songs is very important, and I'm getting better every day. I gotta wait for Jeff East to come back and
switch.
I wrote him a lot of lyrics, but he's been over in Nice right now. I think he's producing something over there, a film. Mm-hmm. And one of these, he hasn't even been down here to the new home, so we gotta get the boy down here, and because he gets up and he can sing the Kansas City blues. He can take anybody on, man. He has got a voice that you talk about being heard in the back row. Damn. Jeff East, that boy could sing.
Clark Kent and Jimmy Olsen together again. What more do you want?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That would be great. Hey, how can your fans find out about this? Can they hear your music somewhere, or do you have a website, Twitter, Facebook, anything?
No, I'm not a big computer guy. The only way you can hear me is just at this point, come down to Palm Springs and find me playing at the Roadhouse, find me playing at the clinic, find me playing at the Scorpion Room, find me playing around town. I mean, there's so many places to play here. And, yeah, but I'm not a computer guy, and I'm, you know, I don't advertise myself very much. I'm really in the low key arena, you know, less is more for me.
Well, you traded your bow tie and your camera for a microphone and a guitar, but I think we'd recognize you anywhere.
Yeah, beautiful 12-string guitar.
Hey, well, all the best. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. We really appreciate it. And bringing this iconic character of Jimmy Olsen to life. For my generation, when I think Jimmy Olsen, you're the one I see.
Wow, I appreciate that, yeah. Well, I appreciate Jimmy. I appreciate Du Bois. I appreciate Dave McFly. I appreciate all those characters I got to play. You know, they're all really good to me, and I love it. Love it.
Thanks so much for joining us.
All right, Joe. We'll talk soon.
Now, in 2013, we celebrated the 75th anniversary of Superman. That certainly includes the 75th anniversary of Jimmy Olsen. And Mark is a big part of that history. My thanks again to Mark McClure for bringing Jimmy to life and for joining me on the show today. As I mentioned, if you're a fan of the Christopher Reeve era Superman films, be sure to check out Comic Book Central episodes 3 and 4, where I talk about the films with producer Ilya Salkind and actor Jack O'Halloran. There are a lot of Superman-themed episodes of Comic Book Central for you to enjoy. More are on the way, so you don't want to miss any episodes. Check us out online at comicbookcentral.net, and be sure to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And I appreciate you rating and reviewing the show while you're on iTunes. Be sure to share The Lair on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork, and Twitter at comicbookctrl. And I always love to get email, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Speaking of emails, virtual Willie Lumpkin stopped by The Lair to deliver a very special message, all the way from the Fortress of Solitude. Seems appropriate on a Superman-themed episode such as this one that we hear from the Man of Steel himself, Bob Holliday, who portrayed Superman in the 1966 Broadway show, It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. Now, I originally reached out to a wonderful woman, Toni Collins, who assists Mr. Holliday with his website. And while Bob is not up to recording an interview for an episode of Comic Book Central, he did want to send a message along to his fans. Toni writes, "Dear Joe, thank you for your kind words. Bob was very touched by your recognition of his contribution to Superman's legacy. Bob says, to all my fans, if you saw me on Broadway, thank you for being there. If you never saw me, but you heard me on the Superman cast album, thanks for the listen. If I met you in Metropolis, Illinois at the Superman celebration, what a thrill. For everyone, I appreciate beyond words that you remember me. I love my time as Superman, and I'm grateful to you all." Wow. Well, I think I can speak for everyone listening when I say the thrill is ours to be able to hear from a legendary talent like Bob Holliday. He not only soared live on stage, he was also the singing Superman. Not an easy task when you're trying to save the world.
"But as for me, I must live not one life but two. This disguise is really wonderful, for who would guess that underneath this white shirt is a great big red S. Every man has his job to do, and my job is doing good. I'll never stop doing good."
If you're not familiar with Bob Holliday's time as Superman, be sure to check out his website, supermanbobholliday.com. There you'll find out all about his life and career, the Broadway show, and how you can order the original cast album from It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. Thanks so much to Toni Collins and Bob Holliday for writing in and sharing their thoughts. Well, just like Marty McFly and his brother and sister, I am disappearing from the picture. But fear not, Comic Book Central shall return in one short week. Next week on Comic Book Central, she pulled off the fanboy trifecta: Charlie's Angel, Bond Girl, and Queen of the Jungle. Tanya Roberts swings into The Lair next time. Until then, have a fantastic week. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in The Lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Life is good.